Everybody would just ring me out. He should have at least taken Vivi, Caro said, standing, walking the length of the porch, her bare feet slapping the boards. Turning and walking back, she picked up a cushion and began to fan Vivi with it. When's he leave? She asked. Where's he go? What's the skinny?
I do think the Air Corps has the cutest uniforms, don't y'all? Niecy asked.
My brother doesn't need a uniform to be handsome, Teensy said.
More hooch, please, Vivi said, holding out her glass.
Teensy splashed more of Mr. Whitman's black market rum into Vivi's glass, and a full moon shimmered over central Louisiana. This was no rinky-dink moon. This was a moon you had to curtsy to, a big, heavy, mysterious, beautiful, bossy moon, the kind you want to serve things to on a silver platter. The noise of the crickets and cicadas and the clinking of ice against the girls' glasses mingled with their voices and sighs. From their spot on the porch, they could see a paradise of stars holding their own with the moon. Taking turns, they stood in front of the fan with wet washcloths held in front of their bodies. They tried lying in bed, but even the sheets felt soggy. When nothing else worked, Teensy started moaning.
Come on, y'all, Teensy said. Moan with me. You'll feel better. I guarantee, mes chers.
And so they moaned, until a dog started howling somewhere, which made them laugh because it sounded like he was trying to communicate with their pack.
Would Tallulah stay here and boil to death? Teensy asked.
Look, pal, Caro said, Eleanor Roosevelt herself wouldn't languish here like this, and she's one tough trooper. Wearing nothing but their father's old seersucker pajama tops over their panties, the four girls pushed Genevieve's convertible to the end of the long drive before Vivi climbed behind the wheel and started it. There was only a dollop of gas in the tank, so they couldn't get far.
I just know we shouldn't be doing this, Niecy said as they journeyed into the night. We should have at least put on pajama bottoms.
Niecy, this is not a mortal sin, you know, said Teensy.
I do not recall it being listed in the Baltimore Catechism, Vivi said.
Moses didn't utter one word about pajama bottoms when he came down from the mountain, said Caro.
Well, Niecy said, I guess these tops do cover more of our bodies than our swimsuits do.
As Vivi drove, it seemed that not only the Yaya's bodies, but the earth and sky were sweating. The very air they breathed was almost a juice. Moonlight spilled down into the convertible, onto the four friends' shoulders and knees, and on the tops of their heads, so that their hair seemed to have little sparks shooting off of it. Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered played on the radio. Vivi had no idea at all where she was headed, but she knew that whatever direction she went, her friends would go with her. She stopped the car at City Park, near a clump of trees, not far from where the water holding tank for the city of Thornton sat atop a raised tower. Turning off the ignition, Vivi dimmed the lights and turned to the others.
Climb to the heavens, anybody?
Top-notch notion, Caro said, jumping out of the convertible, without bothering to open the car door.
Ooh, yes, Teensy said. They don't like you to go up there, Niecy said.
That's one of the reasons we want to do it, Countess, Caro said.
Only the men from the Parks Department are supposed to be up there, y'all, Niecy said. Really?
Niecy, baby doll, said Vivi, getting out of the car. Can it, s'il vous plaît?
Y'all, Niecy continued, we can't climb up there. It is against the law.
We know, Teensy smiled. It's forbidden. Niecy stared at the other three for a moment before she finally opened the car door and joined them.
I don't even want to think about what could happen to us, she said.
Then don't, sweetie pie, Caro said, putting her arm around Niecy.
I'm just going to think me some pretty pink and blue thoughts, Niecy said.
they made their way to the back of the platform, where a crude ladder stopped 6 feet or so above the ground. They took turns giving each other boosts, with Caro, the tallest, going last. As Vivi scrambled up, her heart beat rapidly and sweat ran down the back of her neck. If the sultry heat, the rum, and the late hour were not enough to put her in a trance, the magnitude of the moonlight was. At the top of the ladder, Vivi stepped onto a narrow catwalk that encircled the tank. It was an old wooden water-holding tank, once used by the railroads, but now pushed into service by the city since nearby England Air Force Base and Camp Livingston had swelled its population. From her spot, 20 or so feet above the ground, she looked down on the town of Thornton. She thought of her mother and father, and Pete, and the baby Jazzy, and the wobbly life they lived there. Of the way Buggy stiffened when her husband stepped near. Of the way she said, "Here's your supper, Mr. Abbott," her lips thin and tight. She thought of the way her father laughed at her mother's house dresses, dirty fingernails from gardening, and sanctuary candles. She thought about the faint smell of scotch, not quite disguised with Dr. Titchener's antiseptic tincture on her father's breath. She thought of the clinking sound of his belt buckle when it dangled from the strap. Her mother's discontent lay coiled inside her own body. Ever since Vivi's little sister Jazzy was born, Buggy had slept in the nursery on a daybed against the wall. Although Vivi could not have put it into words, she felt her own exhaustion at constantly attempting to hold back part of her vitality so she would not cause her mother more sadness. At 15, Vivi Abbott was more masterful than most at rationing parts of herself without appearing anything but exuberant. She did not know that the holding back did no good, nor did she have any understanding of the inner rationing her mother had learned herself at a tender age. There was a lot Vivi did not know about her mother. She did not know about the old nightmare that haunted Buggy, the dream that came from something that had happened when her mother was 12 years old. At that age, Buggy had kept a journal filled with her secret feelings and little rhyming, sentimental poems. She wrote about anger toward her sister, Virginia, and her mother, Delia. She wrote romantic, girlish poems about fairies, love, the Virgin Mary, and her love for horses, which Buggy was too afraid to ride. In Buggy's nightmare, it happened just the way it had happened in 1912. Delia found her journal, became infuriated by what Buggy had written in secret, forced Buggy to follow her and Virginia to the backyard. There, Delia ripped the pages from the journal and one by one handed them to Virginia, who fed them into a fire.
"Buggy," Delia had told her, "you are not a writer. There is nothing in your pitiful little life to write about. If anyone is a writer, it is Virginia."
As Buggy watched her secrets go up in smoke, she vowed to get back at her sister. And she did. When she was 19, she managed, through painstaking calculation, to steal Taylor Abbott from Virginia and get him to marry her. He told her she was the sweetest little thing in Garnet Parish and that he wanted her to be his little girl forever. Buggy's victory was a dubious one, however. She was left with a husband who ran around on her for the duration of their marriage. From the top of the water tower, Vivi felt a relief spread through her. What a sweet, small-town thrill this was, like the delight of watching a parade from the top of a tall building. She could see the tangled Spanish moss hanging off the oaks in City Park. She could make out the camellia bushes and azaleas, the salvias. She could smell the night-blooming jasmine. Closing her eyes, she imagined she could look down into her house, into her bedroom, and everything in it. The four-poster bed with the silk canopy Delia had bought for her in New Orleans, the new vanity her father bought for her 15th birthday, on top of which sat a photo of Jack, clad in his basketball uniform, fiddle in hand, the tall armoire crammed with loafers and sweater sets, the ceiling fan, the tennis racket propped against the nightstand, her tennis trophies, countless photos of the Yayas, and one of Jimmy Stewart. Looking away from her parents' house, Vivi imagined she could see the block she lived on, and then her whole neighborhood. She conjured up all the people she knew and the few she didn't. She saw them tossing and turning in their beds, too hot to sleep. She saw lights burning on front porches, slivers of light where icebox doors were open, someone standing there, reaching for a bottle of milk, just an excuse to feel the cool air of the icebox. She saw nightlights in the rooms of the babies who dreamed soft seersucker dreams, drugged happy with the heat, their pink baby bodies curled against worn cotton, not fearing Hitler yet, their strong, tiny hearts beating in unison with the trees and the creeks and the bayous. Vivi saw the flicker of candles burning at Divine Compassion for the souls of the dead. She spotted tiny, fiery red tips of cigarettes dangling from the lips of sleep-starved souls seeking the faintest of breezes in backyards. She caught the soft glow from radio dials left on all night, in case a warning was broadcast, in case the Nazis or Japs invaded on this feverish night, executing the horrors that lived in the town's heart, even as the bank opened for business, as the milk was delivered, as the wafer changed to body and blood. Winging higher still, Vivi left her town, went up so high she could no longer see the trees, or the boulevard, or the faces in ecstasy or worry. She flew above all the forgotten things hanging in the air between people. She lifted above her town until she could see Bunky and Nacogdoches, and how the Cane River was more like a lake, and how the Garnet River fed into the Mississippi. She soared over Spring Creek with its cool shade trees and pine needle paths leading to the cabin where Jack lay sleeping that night. She flew over the German irises with their pale gray-green spikes, above the brown waters of the bayous with their silent cypress trees, over the swamps, over the cotton, over the shotgun houses where the tired black men and women who stooped to pick the cotton slept, over the rice and sugar cane, over the swamp myrtles, over the millions of tiny estuaries, over the crayfish in their beds of mud. Then she left it all and ascended even higher to banks of clouds, perfect clouds cool with mist and closer to heaven. She could see the whole little earth, blue and white, spinning around in terrifying, magnificent space. No people, only hearts, hearts beating, countless hearts, and the sound of breathing. This is how it was for Vivi Abbott. Age 15, labile in every sense of the word. Such were the places she could travel when a tiny gate opened inside her and her mind went loose-jointed. Such holy and terrible suppleness is not always safe and never without trade-offs. For a moment, Vivi stopped feeling solid, and then she began a fast freefall, which carried a shock of impermanence, a panicky jolt of her own temporariness. She clawed to hold on to the moist clouds, to the grand view. She did not want to return to Earth. Back on the water tower platform in City Park, in the heart of the state of Louisiana, Vivi thought, "With Jack Whitman, my life will be different. You can be anything you want, Vivi," he said. "Anything at all." And then Vivi thought, "If Jack disappears into the sky, I will shrivel up and die." Carol was the one who figured out how to pry the lid of the water tower open. It was tricky and required some work, but the Yayas were wily and hot. Even Niecy, the careful Yaya, was captured by the vision of the moonlight in the water. They flung off their pajama tops. Seersucker fluttered through the still air to the parched ground below. The Yayas stepped out of their panties and forgot about collecting scrap metal. They didn't talk much, and they thought even less. They slid into the cool, clear, liquid caress of the city water supply. A bold kind of holiness hung in the air as the yayas leaned their heads back in the water, their hair floating out around their shoulders. They stared up into the bright sky where there wasn't any war. They counted stars, thought they found Pegasus, and were sure they spotted Venus. They touched their toes to one another's and kicked their legs to the heavens like Esther Williams.
Vivi completely gave herself over to the water. A black stone that lived inside her chest was temporarily lifted out, and she breathed deeply, and then released her breath like she was blowing out a candle. Her stomach softened, her shoulders released, her dizziness went away. Then she started to cry. After a few moments, and with no explanation, Teensy's tears joined Vivi's. Then Niecy's, and a few of Caro's. Their tears rolled down their faces and into their community's water. They cried because Jack's enlistment had cracked open their tight universe to the suffering world. They cried because in their highly resonant ya-ya bones, they knew that they would never be the same. Through her tears, Vivi gazed at the moon. A silent prayer for Jack issued from her body.
Moonlight in the summer sky, look down on my love from up on high. Shine on him now while he is safe, and shine on him when he flies through enemy skies. Let his journeys into the sky bring him closer to you, so that while he is away from me, he will be safe. Tell him I love him. Tell him I am longing for him. Tell him I will always wait for him. Your milky brilliance can protect him from all enemies. He is a tender boy. Do not let him suffer. Moonlight over the only town I know, bring my love back home so we can live and be happy.
Turning her head to look at each of her friends, Vivi saw Teensy and Caro and Niecy as she had never seen them before. They seemed to glow from within, like there were lanterns inside their bodies. They looked very old to her, and very young all at once. They looked both invincible and utterly, utterly fragile. Their bodies were the density and weight that anchored her, that made her more real. She looked at them and loved them and was flooded with gratitude. Officer Roscoe Jenkins didn't know what to think when he saw the four pajama tops lying on the ground. He'd been making his regular rounds when he spotted the convertible at the side of the lane and had wondered if someone had run out of gas. The night was so bright he hardly needed his flashlight, but when he shone it on the pajama tops, he saw monograms and grew more perplexed. When he spied the panties, he became alarmed. Holding the shirts in his hand, he looked around but saw nothing out of the ordinary. Then he heard the faint sound of splashing water. He swung his flashlight up in the direction of the water tower, and that's when he thought he saw a naked woman. Once the yayas agreed to come down from the tower, Officer Roscoe Jenkins was every inch a gentleman. Averting his eyes, he handed each one of them a pajama top before climbing up to the tower himself to make sure they had indeed closed the lid back tightly over the water. He knew these young ladies. He'd known the Whitman girl ever since she managed to get a pecan stuck up her nose when she wasn't but four or five. Blowing out the side of his lips and shaking his head, he was more embarrassed than angry. The fact that he let the gang follow him to the station in the convertible, rather than shuffling them into his squad car, was not a sign of trust. Actually, he was a little nervous about sharing a car with the four of them. In Jean-Vier's convertible, there was some controversy about whether they should actually follow him, or gun it and head for the hills. Of course, there were no hills. Teensy finally prevailed.
Come on, she said. I've never been in a lockup before.
When their fathers arrived at the station, rumpled and hot, they conferred among themselves.
"Too bad we can't harness their energy. It'd be an asset to the Allies," Carol's father said. "It's their utter lack of regard for appearances that astounds me," Teensy's father said. "My son has done something praiseworthy, and now my daughter turns into a common criminal. Those four have been a quartet of embarrassments ever since they humiliated my family in Atlanta. I wonder how the water department might go about purifying that holding tank," Niecy's father said.
"Cool them off in a cell for a night," Mr. Abbott said. "Maybe that'll clip the wings."
"Book 'em?" Roscoe said, not believing.
"Book 'em," the fathers agreed. Then they turned and left.
"Book 'em," Teensy said, her hands dramatically clenching the bars of the cell. "Ah, those marvelous words!"
"The pokey," Caro said.
"Jail for our convictions," Vivi said.
"Oh, my," Niecy said.
The cell the girls were escorted to was possibly one of the coolest spots to sleep in all of Thornton. Basement level, with windows on both sides and a side door propped open, not to mention the fan that Officer Roscoe Jenkins moved from his desk to a card table just outside the cell. The space was downright pleasant. Their hair was still wet, their bodies still cool from the water, and Roscoe brought them sodas from the station's icebox, for which they thanked him politely.
"Roscoe," Vivi told him, "when I write my memoirs, you will be much more than a marginal character."
The Yayas drank their sodas and lay on the bunks.
"My pair," Teensy said, "hasn't a shred, not even a shred, of human understanding. Jack is lucky to get away from him."
"We are not common criminals," Caro said.
"There is nothing common about us," Niecy said.
Vivi stared up at the low ceiling of the cell. Sometimes higher laws than Thornton's must be obeyed, she thought. Too many people hide in their rooms when the light of the moon is strongest, when she's bouncing light back to us, whether we want it or not. As the Yayas slept that night in the Thornton City jail, the moon loved them. Not because they were beautiful, or because they were perfect, or because they were perky, but because they were her darling daughters.
Chapter 17. If Sitta Walker had been able to witness Vivi and the Yayas in the light of that summer moon in 1942, their young bodies touching, their nipples luminous in the light, she would have known she came from goddess stock. She would have known that a primal, sweet strength flowed in her mother like an underground stream, and that the same stream flowed in her. Whatever scars Vivi had inflicted with her unhinged swings between creation and devouring, she had also passed on a mighty capacity for rapture. Anxiety hijacked Sitta as she walked down the steps to Lake Quinault. Even as the moon strutted, prissed, and swelled into a gorgeous globe, Sitta was aware only of her own confusion and rattled determination to get to the bottom of things. But a summer moon will put up with inattention for just so long. Just as Sitta was about to place her foot down onto the step in front of her, moonlight tapped her on the shoulder and forced her gaze skyward. She took a long, deep breath, and when she exhaled, she felt a spaciousness that had not been there before. Beholding the moon in its chalky wonder, Sitta thought, "Our Lady of Pearl." That moon is why the word comely was invented. Sitting down on the wooden steps, she reached her hand down to Huey Lean's long, curly ears and began to rub gently. Sitta rubbed and the dog sighed, producing funny little off-key sounds like the cockeyed music a child might blow on a harmonica. Sitta could feel her heart beating and could hear crickets around the lake's edge. Crickets, she thought.
They've serenaded me since the day I was born. Breathe in. Breathe out. Right now I am sitting in the light of the moon. Right now my dog is beside me and we are taking a moon bath. Softly, unexpectedly, she began to sing, something she had not done by herself in a long time. First off, she launched into Blue Moon, singing the alto part that her aunt Jazzy had taught her many years ago. When she finished that, she moved on to Shine On Harvest Moon, accompanying her singing with light foot tapping. Lightly thumping her tail against the wooden steps, Huey Lean watched her mistress. Sitta might as well have been singing dog lullabies. In fact, Sitta was singing a sort of lullaby, songs to calm the baby girl who'd lived inside herself for 40 years. Sitta rubbed the crown of the dog's head, where tufts of white fur sprouted like feathers against the otherwise buff-colored coat. As Sitta stroked, she began to roll her own head around in gentle circles, feeling the tightness in her neck and shoulders. How much does a human head weigh? 20, 25 pounds? She considered the tender stem that connected her head to her heart, and for a moment she experienced a trickle of gratitude. She wondered if it was possible for gratitude to replace anxiety. From Sitta's pondering grew a hum. It drifted along until it blossomed into the song Moon River. She sang the words, remembering how, for a period in the early 60s, after Breakfast at Tiffany's came out, that song had been her parents' favorite. She remembered how it was to step into Chastain's restaurant with Vivi and Shep and blush with delight as the piano player would stop whatever he was playing and switch to Moon River in honor of her parents. How royal it made her whole family seem. Say it was a Saturday evening in what, 1964? Say it was end of summer. Say they all wore a summer glow on their faces. Say Vivi wore a beige linen sheath. Shep wore a sports coat over a pair of khakis. Sitta and Lulu wore new sundresses. Little Shep and Baylor wore crisp polo shirts. Say the meal was lobster. All went well. Say they used finger bowls. Shep gave his old saw, "Lovely meal. I'm elephantly sufficed." Sitta sang as she sat on the dock. "My huckleberry friend," she whispered in Huey Lean's ear when the last verse was finished. This made the cocker spaniel lay her blonde, furry head on Sitta's lap and give a great sigh. Sitta's chest was opened. Her head felt tingly and good. The singing had given the inside of her body a little massage. "I learned to love singing from Mama," she thought. "These days, nobody sings the way Mama and the four of us used to do." What Sitta did not know was how much more singing there was when Vivi was growing up. That's the kind of thing the history books don't tell. How people sang outdoors all the time. How it was impossible to walk down the street in Thornton, Louisiana in the 30s and 40s and not hear somebody singing. Singing or whistling. Housewives singing while they hung out the clothes. Old codgers whistling while they sat in front of the courthouse on River Street. Gardeners humming while they weeded and hoed. Children lilting and yodeling while they tore through the neighborhoods on their Schwinns and radio flyers. Even serious businessmen whistled on their way in and out of the bank. These were people with pianos, not TVs, in their living rooms. Their singing didn't always mean they were happy. Sometimes the tunes were dirges or the old hymns. Often the music flowed from black people whose songs touched a sadness inside Vivi that she herself had no words for. In those days, it seemed everybody sang. When Sitta was growing up, Vivi led her four kids in song as she drove them to school on mornings they missed the bus. She taught each of them to whistle before they could spell, and she made sure they knew all her old camp songs and chosen favorites from the 40s. Sitta and her siblings knew all the verses to Pennsylvania 65,000, Can't Help Lovin' That Man of Mine, and Chattanooga Choo Choo, before they knew how to tie their shoes by themselves. On good days, Vivi would sit at the baby grand that Buggy had given her and pretend their living room was a piano bar,
Sometimes even Shep joined in on tunes like You Are My Sunshine or Yellow Rose of Texas. At those times, Vivi would turn to him and say, "Great, Scott, you have a marvelous voice. You should sing more often. Don't hide your light under a bushel." That would embarrass Shep, who would mumble, "You're the performer in this family, Vivian," and wander off to the kitchen to freshen his drink. Sita loved the moments when her father joined in the free-for-all rambunctiousness her mother encouraged. These occasions were rare, as were any moments with him. Shep loved his children. He loved his wife. But he knew a lot more about farming and duck hunting than he did about being part of a family. Mostly he stuck to what he was good at. Sita can count the number of times she was ever alone with her father, and most of those were after she was grown. He was a man with his own brand of rural poetry, but its expression was gruff with bourbon and unarticulated melancholy. Shep Walker did not fly as high as Vivi, but ever so often, unpredictably, he was capable of unbounded whimsy. Like the Christmas Eve, he came home with cowgirl and cowboy outfits, complete with hats and boots, for each member of the family, including a ridiculous little bitty cowboy hat for their cocker spaniel. He was so delighted with himself that he managed to charm Vivi into allowing all of them, except the dog, to wear the get-ups to Christmas Mass. After Mass, as friends gathered round the Walkers, who looked like a wild offshoot Western singing group gone wrong, Vivi laughed and said, "Saint Shep the Baptist thought Our Lady of Divine Compassion Parish needed a kick in the butt." As a young man, Shep Walker had been a good-looking, lady-killing sleeper of a gentleman farmer who married Vivi Abbott because he coveted her irrepressible vitality. He never stopped to consider why he needed such vigor, nor did he suspect that Vivi's animation had a dark side. It never crossed young Shep Walker's mind that Vivi might, as the years passed, wear him out. The physical attraction they shared when they were courting was almost overpowering, and it had a way of resurfacing over the years, unbidden and sometimes unwanted after long droughts of blame and abstinence. For her part, Vivi married Shep Walker because she adored the sound of his voice, because she loved how he looked so confident after she kissed him, and because, at first, he made her feel like a star, and because she no longer believed, at age 24, that it mattered all that much whom she married. Vivi once told Sita, "I meant to marry Paul Newman, but Joanne Woodward got him first. After that, I didn't give a damn." It was this devil dance between Shep's quiet melancholy and Vivi's frenzied charm, all of it oiled with an endless stream of Jack Daniels, that sculpted Sita's impression of marriage. Later, back inside the cabin, Sita made a glass of Earl Grey iced tea and pulled a floor lamp and chair out onto the deck so she wouldn't lose sight of the moon. The minute she sat down with her mother's scrapbook, Huey Lean flopped a cloth toy against Sita's leg, announcing that it was time for a game of tug-of-war. Looking at the dog, Sita had to laugh. The dog's huge eyes, slightly elongated nose, and curly flaps of ears were so familiar and lovable. Sita got down on her knees and pulled on the toy and growled. The dog was delighted, and they played till Sita gave up and let Huey Lean win. Picking the scrapbook back up, Sita took a deep breath and closed her eyes for a moment before she opened it again. "Unfold to me. Let me unfold." When she opened her eyes, she beheld an invitation. Engraved in script on a card of white Bristol board, the invitation read, "Mr. Taylor Charles Abbott requests the pleasure of your company at a dance in honor of his daughter, Miss Vivian Abbott. Friday, the 18th of December, 1942, at 8 o'clock, Theodore Hotel Ballroom, Thornton, Louisiana." December, 1942. It must have been some sort of Sweet 16 ball. Had they really carried on with such grand events even during the war? Sita turned the card over. Where in the hell was her grandmother's name? The omission took her breath away. Was it an oversight? If this blackballing of her grandmother was intentional, then what did it mean? Once again, she longed to be able to pick up the telephone and simply ask her mother, but Vivi had made her feelings clear. Do not call. Sitta looked at her watch. 9 o'clock. 11 o'clock, Louisiana time. Carol would still be awake. She'd just be gearing up, downing the thick black community coffee she adored. The one true Yaya night owl would still be receiving phone calls unless her life had radically changed. Up until the New York Times interview, Carol still called Sitta every couple of months and always after midnight. But they had not spoken since the offending article. Not since Vivi had handed down the fatwa. Grabbing a flashlight and Huey Lean's leash, Sitta and her cocker spaniel struck out for the phone booth at the Quinault Merck. The road was deserted. All the happy campers bedded down for the night. When Sitta passed the Quinault Lodge, she saw the warm lights in the lobby still burning and felt a little comfort knowing that she could wander in there anytime she wanted, if she grew tired of being alone. She liked the late-night buzz she felt. She liked the frisson she experienced as she set forth to sleuth out information about Vivi Abbott, age 16.
Eating cheese biscuits and playing with the damn full CD-ROM, that's what I'm doing, Caro said, drawing in a ragged, emphysemic breath. How about you, pal?
Caro, Sitta said, I'm out here on the edge of the United States, trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life.
That is a filthy habit for such a lovely girl, Caro said in a near-perfect Groucho Marx voice.
Sitta laughed, picturing the way Caro's shoulders shrugged when she tossed off a comment like that.
I can't help it. I'm an addict.
Sitta sat on the narrow shelf of a bench inside one of the few 1950s vintage public phone booths left in North America. She unhooked Huey Lean's leash and gave her a command to sit.
Don't corrupt that word addict, goddammit, Caro said. I'm fed up with everybody claiming they're addicted. You're just a ponderer, Sitta. That's all. Have been since you were 4. It's your nature. What else is new?
You don't sound very surprised to hear from me.
Should I be?
After, well, all the mess with that fat-ass New York reporter, come on. What do you take me for?
My mother's best friend.
That's true, Caro said, then paused. I'm also your godmother.
You're not upset with me?
No, I'm not.
Then why didn't you call? Why didn't you write?
Well, to quote that pointy-head idiot George Bush, it wouldn't have been prudent.
Caro, when have you ever been prudent?
When it comes to my friends, I have been known on occasion to be prudent.
There was a silence while Sitta thought of how to respond.
I sent Blaine and Richard up to see your play, Caro said. You know that, don't you? I sent my ex-husband and his boyfriend up there to see your tour de force and report back to me.
Sitta never stopped marveling at Caro. Growing up, Caro's husband Blaine had always turned heads in the French Quarter. But when he finally left Caro for the man he'd been secretly seeing in New Orleans, it had rocked the whole Yaya universe. That was 8 or 9 years ago. After threatening Blaine with an unloaded gun and tearing up an entire portfolio of architectural drawings for a house he was designing, Caro had finally forgiven him. As she had explained things the last time Sitta had been home 2 years earlier,
it's a shock, but it's not a surprise. And the fact is, I really like Richard. The man can cook, for God's sake. Nobody has cooked for me since Mama died.
Blaine moved to New Orleans to live with Richard, but they were always driving up to Thornton to stay with Caro, especially since she'd been diagnosed with emphysema.
I know Blaine and Richard saw the show, Sitta said.
I mean, Connor and I took them out while they were in New York. But what do you mean you've sent them?
I mean, Carol said, I bought the goddamn tickets for the play, and I instructed the lovebirds that if they didn't come back with a detailed description of women on the cusp and graphic particulars on how you looked, sounded, and behaved, that I would turn them over to the Divine Compassion Vice Squad. And the boyfriends told me not to worry. Said you were gracious, good-looking, if a little thin, sad about your mama, but proud of your success, and that they, and I quote, adored Connor McGill. If I recall correctly, Richard said he's Liam Neeson crossed with a young Hank Fonda who spent a few sessions on the couch. Jesus, Sidda said, how do you put up with those two? Excuse me a second, please, Carol. Healing, get back over here, Sidda called out to the spaniel who was starting a slow lumbering across the road in the direction of the lake. Sorry, the dog was wandering off, she apologized. Is that code language for something? Carol asked. No, Sidda laughed, realizing she had just uttered the kind of phrase the Yayas would use to convey a piece of information they didn't want anyone else to understand. It's Huey Lean, the theater dog. Are you still carrying that dog around with you everywhere you go? Yes, Sidda said. She has this thing like epilepsy, you know. I don't like to kennel her. Connor calls it puppylepsy. She's on downers. Don't tell me you've turned into a nut, Caro said. Well, you should talk, Caro, Sidda said. You're the woman who once raised a litter of 4 beagles, if I recall. Now, what about this hunk, Connor? What about... You still haven't answered my question, Sidda said, changing the subject. She did not want to discuss her postponement of the wedding with Caro. How do you put up with Blaine and Richard? I not only put up with them, I relish them. Blaine's 10 times more fun. Every time Blaine and Richard come to visit, they cook, redecorate, and throw me a party. How could I not enjoy the hell out of them? Caro then began to cough. It was a horrible, ragged cough that hurt Sidda's chest to hear. She pictured the Caro she grew up knowing, tall, tanned, athletic, emerging from swimming laps in Teensy's pool, reaching for a cigarette before she'd even dried off. Baylor had told her that Caro's battle with emphysema was up and down. I'm sorry, I didn't call, pal, Caro said softly. It was just too goddamn touchy down here with Vivi. She made us swear not to talk to you. Your mama's terrified of betrayal. By the way, don't let the coughing bother you. It sounds worse than it is. Always flares up at night.
Sidda was quiet for a moment. Do you feel I betrayed her?
No, I don't. I think the New York Times and every other woman-hating publication in this country would like to siphon the milk out of every single mother's tits and then blame them for being dry. But no, I do not think you meant to hurt your mother.
Thank you.
Don't thank me, Sidda.
May I ask you a question? Carol coughed again before she responded. Sidda winced. When Caro spoke, she sounded wary.
Depends on what it is.
I found this invitation in Mama's scrapbook to a dance thrown on her 16th birthday. My grandmother's name is missing from the invitation. It reads like Buggy wasn't even alive.
You ask Vivi about it?
She doesn't want to talk about the scrapbook. In fact, Mama doesn't want to talk to me at all. She says she sent the divine secrets, and that's enough.
Isn't it?
Is it what? Sidda said.
Isn't the scrapbook enough? Carol said.
No, it's not enough, Sitta said. It irritates me. It frustrates me to look through that scrapbook and only get inklings, only tiny slivers of information. No explanations for anything, no dramatic structure. When I know there must be stories, narratives that could solve, maybe not solve, but account for. Mama owes me some pointers, for God's sake.
Sitta cleared her throat, embarrassed at her outburst. Caro didn't speak for a moment.
You think your mama has something to do with your cold feet about Connor McGill?
I don't know, Sitta said. I'm a little shocked at my vehemence about all this, to tell you the truth.
I'm not. You and your mama have broken each other's hearts. But while you're slinging arrows, let me remind you that you do have a father, Sitta. Understandable that you should overlook him, vanishing act that he is. Not that that distinguishes him from any other Yaya husband.
Yeah, but Mama was always the star. Daddy was a bit player.
How many years of therapy did you say you've had?
Put it this way, with the money I've spent trying to deal with the ways Mama fucked me up, I could have retired at the age of 30.
Let me tell you something, pal. Your mother doesn't owe you anything. You're a grown-up. She fed you and clothed you and held you, even if she did have a drink in her hand while she was doing it. And however she fucked you up, and I'm sure she did. Every mother fucks every kid up. She did it with style. You hear me?
Sitta reached down to pull Huey Lean closer to her. Therapy has done some good. 5 years ago, I would have gone catatonic if someone spoke such blunt, crazy wisdom to me.
You still breathing? Caro asked softly.
Yep.
I think about breathing a whole lot these days, Caro said. Uncountable the number of breaths I've taken for granted in my life.
Caro's words swept into Sitta with the air she was breathing and caused her to notice her breath. For a moment, Sitta said nothing. She simply rode with her breath, like a surfer on an afternoon wave. At opposite ends of the country, she and Caro breathed into their telephones, neither of them speaking. Eventually, Caro said,
"Okay, about that Sweet 16 business. It was ugly."
"What do you mean?" Sitta asked.
"You really want to talk about this?"
"Are you tired?" Sitta asked. Caro breathed raggedly. If Sitta hadn't known better, she would have thought the breath was stagey.
The man had settled some big case. What have you, wanted to strut his money. Your grandmother Buggy didn't want to have that dance. Your grandfather did it to spite her. God damn it, Taylor Abbott treated your grandmother like a piece of shit. Weird as she was, she didn't deserve it. Ran around on her for years. Every maid in the parish knew about it. He treated his horses better than he did his wife. Hell, I don't know. Your mama got caught in the middle of all their shit.
Caro was silent for a moment before she continued.
That dance. Taylor Abbott gave Vivi this drop-dead diamond ring. It was the last big party before we lost Jack. Not a birthday you'd want to remember.
Sitta waited for Caro to say more, but she didn't.
Is that all, Caro? Sitta asked. What happened? How did all this affect Mama?
Your Mama's next birthday is going to be grand. I can tell you that, Caro said, ignoring Sitta's probing. We're planning the party for October rather than December, Vivi announced. She wanted an outdoor party this year, so we need to have it before it gets cold. I'm doing the invitations on my Macintosh.
Carol began to cough. Queen of evasion, Sitta said.
Godmother of evasion, Carol said in a weary voice.
You're tired. I've kept you too long.
Yes, I am tired, Val.
Thank you for answering my question.
I didn't answer your question.
No, you didn't.
There is no answer, Carol said. There never has been an answer. There never will be an answer. That's the answer. Gertrude Stein.
You're the second person to quote Gertrude Stein to me this week.
Life ain't no Baltimore catechism, pal. Carol Bennett Brewer.
Sitta laughed. From where she stood, she could see part of the moon through the tall, inky black silhouettes of the old Douglas firs that lined the lake. Carol, Sitta said, tentative. There's one more thing.
What's that?
There's this photo. Looks like it's from the early 60s. It's a group photo at an Easter egg hunt. Looks like it might be at Teensy's. We're all lined up holding baskets, dressed to the nines. Everyone's there. You, Blaine, the boys, Teensy, Niecy, all the petit yayas. Chick's dressed up in this crazy bunny outfit with a cigarette in his hand. All of Niecy's brood, except for Frank, who was probably taking the picture. Daddy and the four of us are there. Baylor looks like he's screaming bloody murder, and I'm wearing this Alice in Wonderland organdy affair, complete with hat. My arms are around little Shep and Lulu, and we all look slightly tortured. The curious thing is that Mama's not there. She was gone that Easter, wasn't she? Where was she, Carol? Carol was silent.
Oh, boy. She finally said, dodging. Back in the days of the smoking bunnies.
That picture makes me sad, Sitta said. I think it was after we drove Mama away.
What? Carol said.
When we got to be too much for Mama. When she went away.
Haven't you and Vivi ever talked about this, Sitta?
No, Sitta said. We haven't. Carol was silent. She went away because of me, didn't she, Carol? Carol began to cough then, and Sitta felt guilty.
No, pal, Carol said. She didn't go away because of you. Life is more complex than that.
What are you saying, Carol?
There's a lot more than you're gonna find in a scrapbook. Now go do something sweet for yourself. Like Niecy says, go and thank you.
Go and thank me some pretty pink and blue thoughts. There was a pause.
That means I love you, Sitta Lee.
I know, Caro, Sitta said. I love you, too. A spasm of coughing followed. Then Caro said,
sleep tight. Don't worry about the boogeyman. I've fumigated under the bed.
There is the truth of history, and there is the truth of what a person remembers. As Sitta sat at the edge of Lake Quinault, memory blossoms floated, unbounded, as though breathed, no words spoken. Like birds that fly across national borders between countries at war with each other. Chapter 18. Sitta sat in the phone booth and practiced breathing. You are a grown-up. Do I expect Mama to be responsible for my life? Because she gave me physical birth, do I expect her to give me spiritual birth as well? Have I not forgiven her for being ripped from the womb of innocence and flung screaming into the raw, cruel, glorious demands of this world? Do I expect Connor to do what Mama couldn't or wouldn't? Am I afraid that I don't deserve him? Am I afraid he will leave me if I'm not good enough? She punched in Connor's number. She heard the phone ring 5 times, and then his voice on the answering machine.
Hi, Connor McGill and Sitta Walker aren't in now, but we'd like to know you called.
The sound of his voice aroused her.
Hey, Dreamboat, Sitta said softly into the phone. Huey Lean, the canine governor, misses you. It's late. It smells like pine pitch and wild roses out here. Still no meteors. Is that starry, starry sky stuff all fiction?
She made a little kiss-kiss sound into the receiver and hung up. Was Connor still at the theater? Or the opera house? Or was he out having a glorious time at some groovy place without her?
Fool.
What are you doing, leaving him like this? As she and Huey Lean walked along the lake path in the direction of the cabin, Sitta found herself thinking about her own birthdays. She remembered how it was to awake back then, midwinter at Pecan Grove. The first sound she'd hear on those mornings was the mingling of Vivi's, Little Shep's, Lulu's, and Baylor's voices as they sang happy birthday to her. It was so early on those mornings that the fields and the bayou were still shrouded in darkness. Baylor and Lulu were still half asleep, rubbing their eyes, their young voices husky with sleep, pajamas all wampus-sided. Little Shep, wired from the instant he woke up, was jumping around in the doorway of her bedroom. Sitta would open her eyes to see 4 people she loved most in the world, their faces lit by the glow of birthday candles on the cake Vivi was holding. She'd gaze up at her mother, still clad in her pink Barbizon nightgown, face gleaming with Butyr overnight cream. Sitta would smell the scent of the candles burning, feel the soft cotton sheets, the weight of the covers just right on her body. Sitting up in bed, she'd sense the just-waked-up scent of her family. She would not smell her father because he was not there. Where was he? Already out in the fields, still sleeping, away at the duck camp, his second home. Sitta would sit up in bed on those mornings, mouth wide open at the beauty of the tiny birthday candles glowing in her dark bedroom. After they finished singing, Vivi would bend down to kiss Sitta.
I'm so glad I had you, she would whisper into her daughter's ear.
Some birthdays, Vivi's voice might be hoarse from smoke or tears, or both. Sometimes the tension in her mother's voice was so high it resonated in her daughter's just-waking body. Some birthdays Vivi was so hungover she'd wince even as she sang. The year after Vivi got sick and went away, her eyes were so red and puffy, her voice so weak, her panic so close to the surface. Even as a child, Sitta sensed how much it cost her mother to sing, to hold out a rose-bedecked cake at dawn, and to whisper, "Sitta Lee Walker, I'm so glad I had you." As Sitta remembered the singing of her siblings, she wondered how it was they'd grown so far apart. With the exception of Baylor, none of them kept in touch. Little Shep, Lulu, and Baylor would climb on her bed as Sitta blew out the candles and made her wish. Then Vivi would relight the candles, and Sitta would blow them out all over again, this time with help from the others. Vivi would leave the room and reappear with a tray set with good china dessert saucers, forks, and 4 tall crystal glasses of milk. They'd switch the bedside lamp back on, and Sitta would reach greedily for the biggest rose on the cake and plop it into her mouth. After that, she'd royally decide which remaining flowers would go to whom. Vivi encouraged total self-indulgence on their birthdays, and the mere knowledge that on her birthday Sitta didn't have to share made her want to. As they licked sugar roses, Vivi would make them promise not to tell their father. Big Shep claimed eating cake like that so early in the morning was a whore's breakfast. The rest of them didn't care. They were happy little whores who didn't worry about saving a morsel. They knew that Vivi ordered not 1, but 2 birthday cakes from the bakery for birthdays, one for their morning orgy and another for the birthday party
later in the day. Vivi worked hard to make every birthday a good one. It was as though she had made a covenant with herself that she would do anything within her power not to let a birthday go bad. As Sita walked along the lake, she occasionally stumbled over the thick, knotted tree roots that crisscrossed the path. Although she carried a small flashlight and the light of the moon was strong, if she wasn't careful, the very vividness of her memories caused her to lose her footing. She felt safe here on the Olympic Peninsula. It had been too long since she felt so protected. As a girl, she'd walk like this at night at Spring Creek, guarded by the creeks and the pine trees and the cicadas. After all her years of living in the city, it was a relief to feel her shoulders relax. It was a relief not to have to glance behind her every few steps to see if she was about to be mugged. She remembered a dramatic theory seminar she'd taken in graduate school in which liminal moments on stage were discussed. Liminal moments, those moments apart from time, when you are gripped, taken, when you are so fully absorbed in what you are doing that time ceases to exist. Those early morning birthday moments were liminal, Sita thought. Mama knew how to embrace liminality, in spite of, or maybe because of, her emotional acrobatics. Mama taught me rapture. What were Mama's birthdays like when she was a girl? What was that 16th birthday like? Did Buggy bring her a cake in bed? Hard to imagine. What happened? Was there a viscous glue of jealousy passed down from mother to daughter in our lineage, invisible and life-threatening as cancer? Sita didn't want to think about jealousy and Vivi. Not that it hadn't been suggested to her by her therapist, by her friends. Sita didn't even like the word jealousy. She was superstitious about using it. The harder Sita tried to block certain thoughts from her mind, the less aware she grew of the sweet summer air that surrounded her along the lake. As she walked, she tried to think pretty pink and blue thoughts, but old gray thoughts walked behind her, quacking and biting at her heels. You are not a child anymore. The first time Sita was socked in the stomach with the full impact of the word jealousy was on the opening night of the first professional play she directed. It was a production of Death of a Salesman at the Portland